Astana's 12th advisory body, the CPPCC, convenes the first session of its new five-year term in Beijing. The highlights will be the election of a new Chinese leadership in 10 days' time. Iraq says it will stop the destruction of banned Al-Samud 2 missiles if the U.S. decides to attack the country unilaterally. Turkish ruling party leader Tayyip Erdogan says he's not ruling out a second attempt to get parliament approval to allow U.S. troops into the country. And Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has his first cabinet meeting since getting approval for his new rightist coalition last week. Hello and welcome to this edition of Worldwide Watch. I'm Li Xin. We begin here in Beijing, where China's top advisory body, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, or CPPCC, has convened the first plenary session of its new five-year term. Over 2,000 members from various social strata will offer suggestions and criticism on state affairs over the next 11 days. More importantly, they will witness a transfer of power to China's new leadership next week. Mei Yan has the details.
These are some of China's most brilliant minds. They are going to have their solemn say in handling state affairs. Every March for the next 5 years, we will bring their proposals and debate the way forward in shaping the nation.
I think the issues of education and public health in rural areas should be stressed by the government.
I'm mainly concerned about how to protect the legal interests of the working class.
As a new term starts, 50% of the CPPCC is made up of fresh faces, as a growing number of promising business people from state-owned enterprises and the private sector are joining the ranks. The opening ceremony was presided over by a member of Standing Committee of the Politburo of the CPC Central Committee, Jia Qingling. CPPCC Vice Chairman Li Guoxian delivered a report summarizing the work of the 9th CPPCC Standing Committee over the past 5 years. He said the advisory body provides powerful support to major state affairs.
The Standing Committee of the CPPCC National Committee held 20 meetings, and its chairman and vice chairman met on 48 occasions to express their views on a large number of major issues, including rural work, state enterprise reform, and a series of major resolutions adopted by the central leadership.
Li Guoxian added, the new century poses new tasks and challenges to the CPPCC as the country aims to build a comprehensive well-off society. At a meeting, CPPCC representatives also heard a report on proposals relating to delegation and handling of the body's work. Over the last 5 years, the advisory body collected over 27,200 proposals concerning various issues dealing with the nation's social, political, and economic life. 98.8% of them have been dealt with by relevant government organizations. This year's session is scheduled to last through March 14th. The highlight will be the election of the representatives of a new CPPCC central leadership. They will also attend a plenary session of China's top legislative body and deliberate on a government report by the Chinese Premier Zhu Rongji.
Fiscal policy, employment, social security, the list goes on. And all these issues are going to be discussed by China's think tank in the next 10 days. With growing and changing membership, the top advisory body is expected to work closely together with a new generation of Chinese leaders towards the goal of building China into a healthy and wealthy society. CCTV in Beijing.
The CPPCC is the main part of China's political consultation and democratic supervision system and draws its members from all walks of life. Since its establishment more than half a century ago, it has seen steady development. Liang Liming now takes a closer look at the nation's top government advisory body.
These buildings, situated in a small street in western Beijing,
might be a lesser-known emblem of Chinese politics than the Great Wall of the People, yet they are seat to one of China's key political institutions, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. These large hallways and meeting rooms are where members of the nation's top government advisory body discuss issues that have a vital bearing on the nation's politics and economy and the people's livelihood. The CPPCC was established shortly before the founding of New China. Its first plenary session, held in September 1949, saw the passage of the Common Program of the CPPCC, which served as the country's provisional constitution. During its early days, the CPPCC functioned as the nation's top legislature. With the establishment of the National People's Congress in 1954, the main function of the CPPCC shifted to include political consultation, democratic supervision, and participation in various state affairs. CPPCC members are drawn from a spectrum of political parties, including the ruling Chinese Communist Party and 8 non-communist parties, non-government organizations, and various social sectors. Every March, they gather in Beijing for National Conference, which coincides with the annual session of the National People's Congress. During this time, they attend the NPC's plenary sessions as observers, discuss the government work report, and submit motions to lawmakers. In between the annual sessions, they are invited for discussions over various policy initiatives, where their opinions are solicited to facilitate government decision-making. Members may also supervise the implementation of laws, regulations and policies by submitting motions on issues of their concern.
Over the last 5 years, CPPCC members have submitted a total of nearly 17,000 proposals addressing all aspects of political, economic and social life. They are forwarded to government agencies for careful deliberation and provide effective guidance for decision making.
The CPPCC has committees at the national and local levels. The National Committee has 8 subcommittees. Throughout the year, the committees organize research programs and inspection tours for members to gather findings and form opinions. Over the past 50-plus years, the CPPCC has become more broadly representative. Data from the latest session show that members from outside the Communist Party have come to account for more than half of the total. Representation of newly emerging social sectors, such as private entrepreneurs and professionals, has also been on the rise.
With political civilization emerging as one of the catchwords of the 16th National Congress of Chinese Communist Party last November, it's been agreed among many CPPCC members that the advisory body will have greater participation in national affairs. The strengthening voice of CPPCC in the nation's political life will be felt in the days and years to come. Yang Liming, CCTV.
For members of the CPPCC, macro policies are just part of their considerations. One of their main responsibilities, both in and off session, is to submit proposals highlighting people's everyday concerns. These range from education to the environment, even to prices in supermarkets. Reporter Wang Xing has been tracking 2 proposals on Beijing's environment and has filed this report.
With the decibel level this high, it's not such a good idea to live anywhere near the railway tracks. But for years, residents in this part of downtown Beijing had to put up with it. Trains pass by about every 10 minutes. Thicker windows used to be the only, though still unsatisfactory solution. The noise gets so loud, sometimes it's unbearable. Feeling the pain of residents living on both sides of the railway is Zhang Huajun, a local mayor and a member of China's political advisory body. At last year's CPPCC national session, Zhang Huajun proposed to reduce the noise by lowering train speeds and banning the use of horns upon entering Beijing's urban area.
I propose that trains entering the city proper deal with the noise pollution they bring on residents.
3 months later, a letter from Beijing's Railway Bureau promised to take action. Shortly after, Zhang found the trains began to slow down and horns were almost completely silent. He says he's glad to see the improvements, but that it's not enough.
I will still suggest the installation of sound shields along the railway in addition to banning the horns.
Professor Ma Jing feels the same way about roads. She proposed a year ago that shielding be installed along Beijing's apartment-lined highways. Action was taken, but the job isn't finished yet.
I'm satisfied that along the new roads, shielding has been taken into consideration. But I'm not satisfied because old roads haven't been considered.
Professor Ma Jin and Jiang Huajun addressed two of the more than 2,000 members of the CPPCC, China's top advisory body. For them, every annual session is not just about advising the decision makers about the country's macro policies. It's also about the everyday concerns of the average people. CCTV.
You're watching Worldwide Watch. So to come after a short break, Iraq says it will stop the destruction of the banned Al-Samud 2 missiles as the U.S. decides to attack the country unilaterally. And Turkish ruling party leader Tayyip Erdogan says he's not ruling out a second attempt to get parliament approval to allow U.S. troops into the country.
今天呢正式开幕了，我作为一个百姓呢，也非常关注两会的召开。这些个代表们带来什么提案呢？他们关心的热点问题是什么？通过这些个讨论通过，这些问题的改进，给人民的生活思想带来这个推动吧。
我最关心的是，还是我们这次我们在十六大之后，我们这个国家面临着这样大的这么好的一个态势，我们国民经济如何更快的、更健康的发展起来？这是我们少数民族边境地区的建设，包括基础设施建设，还有发展经济，要强边固防。
第二一个呢，就是加强生态环境保护建设。希望能够就是说尽快的这个制定文化产业的政策，让做文化产业的这些个民营企业和国营企业的都是要有法可循，有规律可循。
我们好多。 北京的毕业的、广东毕业的、上海毕业的、天津毕业的，很多优秀的人才，到了西部地区，是不是真的发挥了它的作用？很难讲，应该在西部地区有更大的作用的发挥，提供更好的一些条件。
Iraq will stop the destruction of the banned Al-Samud 2 missiles if the U.S. decides to attack Iraq unilaterally. Saddam Hussein's scientific advisor Amer al-Sadi made the warning on Sunday. He also said Iraq had sent several letters to the UN inspectors in which all the remaining issues, including VX agents and anthrax, were addressed. Joel Maltese has more details.
Speaking at a news conference at the Ministry of Information in Baghdad, Amer al-Sadi indicated that Baghdad could cut off destruction of the banned missiles if the U.S. signals it will attack.
If it turns out at an early stage during this month that America is not going the legal way, then why should we continue?
In line with the UN disarmament demand, Iraq began to destroy its banned Al-Samud 2 missiles on Saturday. Four missiles were destroyed on Saturday and another six on Sunday, Saadi said. UN weapons inspectors are receiving proactive cooperation from the Iraqi side. Commenting on why no photos concerning the destruction process were released to the public, he said the photos would be harsh to Iraqis. UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is due to make a crucial report on Friday to the Security Council on Iraqi compliance. He said destruction of the missiles would be a significant piece of real disarmament. Blix has ordered Iraq to destroy all the missiles and most components. The process is expected to take around 2 weeks. Joan Maltese, CCTV.
The United Arab Emirates has become the first Arab nation to publicly call for Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to step down. The UAE floated the idea at the Arab League summit held Saturday in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The UAE appeal suggested that Iraq should come under temporary UN and Arab League tutelage once Saddam has stepped down voluntarily. The appeal was so controversial that the summit did not even discuss it. But privately, many Arab leaders began endorsing the idea as a viable alternative to a possible disastrous war. As Arab countries ponder their next move, other parts of the world are making their anti-war stance known. Joan Maltese has this report.
We are in the process.
France's Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin refused to rule out the possibility of a veto to a second UN resolution on Iraq. In a television interview on Sunday, he said he believed that Saddam Hussein had begun to truly disarm and called for more inspectors to Iraq to aid in the effort. The French foreign minister declared that his country's opposition to a U.S.-led war had nothing to do with anti-Americanism. Instead, he said the real motivation was to save lives. Sunday was not a day of rest for people in Casablanca, Karachi, Hiroshima, and Sydney. In Morocco, around 50,000 demonstrators marched through Casablanca to protest against a possible U.S. attack on Iraq. Organizers said all political parties and Islamic groups put aside their differences and united under the anti-war banner. Their effort was echoed in Pakistan, where about 70,000 protesters took to the streets of Karachi, holding high placards reading, "No Blood for Oil." In the Japanese city of Hiroshima, which suffered the world's first atomic bombing in 1945, over 6,000 people took part in a rally. While calling for a peaceful solution to the Iraqi issue, citizens of Hiroshima expressed their deep concern about the use of depleted uranium shells. Across the Pacific in Sydney, Australian women demonstrated their opposition to a military attack on Iraq with calls for no war spelled out in a unique way. About 1,000 naked women lying down on a sports field delivered their clear opposition to their government's support of Washington's hardline stance against Iraq. Joan Maltese, CCTV.
Leader of the Turkish ruling party, Tayyip Erdogan, says his government is reviewing its options after parliament refused to allow U.S. troops into the country. He is not ruling out an eventual second attempt to win approval. Erdogan said on Sunday that Turkey's relationship with U.S. is strong enough to ride out the problem and that his government is considering all alternatives. He also warned Iraq not to exploit the Turkish parliamentary decision as an encouragement to delay cooperation with the UN arms inspections. Earlier in the day, Turkish Prime Minister Abdullah Gül said the friendship and mutual understanding between Turkey and the U.S. will continue. He said the Turkish government will evaluate the situation calmly and take whatever measures necessary. Coming up after a short break, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon held his first cabinet meeting since getting approval for his new rightist coalition last week. And in Estonia's general election, the center-left Center Party gets a narrow victory at the polls, but it may not be enough to seal power.
In the name of peace, the United States will lead a coalition of the willing to disarm the Iraqi regime.
We want peace. We want justice. We want peace.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon met with his new cabinet on Sunday following the parliament's approval of his rightist coalition last week. Sharon's Likud party dominates the new cabinet, taking 14 portfolios, including foreign affairs, defense, finance and the premiership. The Shinui party, the largest of Likud's three partners, received 5 cabinet portfolios. The other partners are the National Religious Party, which supports the interests of Jewish settlers in the West Bank, and the National Union, an ultra-nationalist bloc that rejects any concessions to the Palestinians. Silvan Shalom has been appointed foreign minister. Former Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been offered the finance post. Syrians voted on Sunday in the first parliamentary election since President Bashar al-Assad succeeded his father in 2000. The ruling Ba'ath Party is widely expected to emerge dominant, but analysts say the new assembly could help accelerate reforms. Zoe Osbrook has more.
Syria's two-day parliamentary elections opened on Sunday morning. About 11 million voters will choose 250 representatives for the People's Assembly from 4,945 candidates, a mix of independents and members of political parties. The current parliament finished its four-year term late last year. The Assembly is a full legislative body that can amend the constitution and other laws and can deliver a vote of no confidence against the cabinet or any of its ministers. The ruling socialist Arab Ba'ath Party and its 6 allies in the left-leaning National Progressive Front traditionally dominate the assembly, and analysts say this is unlikely to change. But many expect the new house to speed up economic and political reforms introduced by the young Assad. Since he succeeded his late father, Hafez al-Assad, the Western-educated ophthalmologist has introduced much-needed economic reforms and allowed a measure of political tolerance that Syria lacked for decades. Zoe Alterbrook, CCTV.
Estonia's centre-left Centre Party has narrowly won a general election, but it remains unclear whether the party can govern. Analysts had expected the Centre Party leader Edgar Savisaar to coast to victory, but the final election results showed the Centre Party was only 0.8% ahead of Res Publica, which garnered 24.6% support. A shock result lifted hopes on the right that Res Publica could form a coalition with other centre-right parties and force Savisaar into opposition. As none of the 6 parties has won a majority, it is expected to take days before a ruling coalition can emerge. In Venezuela, a suspected car bomb explosion in the oil-rich city of Maracaibo has severely damaged several buildings, including a local office of U.S. oil giant Chevron Texaco. But police say the oil company does not appear to have been the main target. The car bomb was planted outside the home of a man whom police described as a controversial figure in Venezuela's oil worker strike, which ended recently. 9 people were in the house, but all escaped unharmed. Police were investigating the possibility that the attack might have been directed against his family. The blast was the 3rd bomb attack in the city in a week after the Colombian and Spanish embassies were targeted. The Venezuelan president has blamed his opponents for the attack. A Japanese court has sentenced 6 executives to suspended jail terms ranging from 3 to 5 years for allowing workers to use buckets to fill a tank with uranium, triggering the country's worst nuclear accident back in September 1999. The 6 admitted negligence in the accident, which killed 2 workers and caused hundreds of people living near the uranium processing plant to be exposed to radiation. The former head of the plant was also fined nearly $4,500. A string of accidents, scandals and cover-ups in recent years has deeply dented public confidence in Japan's nuclear industry and its 52 commercial reactors. Resource-poor Japan relies on nuclear power for 1/3 of its electricity output and still plans to raise that to 40% by 2012. In other news, China is keen to expand its media cooperation with other nations. CCTV 9, the national English-language TV channel, is landing in Britain and France today. Han Bin has this story.
A landmark agreement with France and Britain's TV networks has been signed. Starting on Monday, CCTV 9 is officially reaching the two nations through Britain's B-Sky B and France's TPS. The agreement was initiated by China International TV Corporation, News Corp, and the European and Asian Sports Channel. B-Sky B is the biggest satellite TV program service provider in the United Kingdom. It reaches 6 million households across the country. TPS is one of the two biggest satellite TV service providers in France. It has 1.2 million customers. With the agreement, China's English programs will reach tens of thousands of British and French households. China hopes its programs will provide a window onto its vibrant culture and dynamic economy. Hanbin, CCTV.
Finally, some financial news. Asian stocks jumped as some investors were persuaded the war could be delayed after Baghdad's destruction of missiles and a setback for U.S. plans to use Turkish soil for an attacking pad. U.S. stocks rallied earlier on surprisingly healthy readings on business activity in the U.S. Midwest and economic growth for the fourth quarter of 2002. But by mid-session, much of the rally outside of the technology sector was gone amid renewed concerns over a U.S.-led war with Iraq. Now let's take a close look at the figures. And that's it for this edition of Worldwide Watch on CCTV International. I'm Li Xing in Beijing. From everyone here on the team, thank you for joining us.